100 UTC.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. An aid ship loaded with some 200 tons of food for Gaza has set sail for Cyprus and should arrive in about 3 days. More on the attempts to deliver that aid from Reuters' Lucy Fielder.
The aid ship was funded mostly by the UAE and organized by US-based charity World Central Kitchen, with much of Gaza reduced to rubble. WCK said it was building a landing jetty with material from destroyed buildings. Open Arms spokesperson Laura Lanuza.
There has been a naval blockade from Israel since over 20 years ago. So for us, makes us really, really happy and proud.
Qatar's foreign ministry spokesperson Majid Al-Ansari said on Tuesday negotiators seeking a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas were not close to a deal. There'd been hopes for a truce in time for Ramadan, which began this week.
That is Reuters' Lucy Fielder reporting. Yemen's Houthi rebels have targeted a Liberian flag container ship in the Red Sea with missiles on Monday, producing an explosion near the vessel but causing no damage. Uncertainty over Haiti's political future on Tuesday after its prime minister said he would step down, a move welcomed by many Haitians, exhausted by months of escalating gang violence, but with questions over security still to be settled. Reuters' Emma Jelly.
Kenya's government did an about-face on Tuesday, announcing it was pausing a long-delayed deployment of Kenyan police officers to tackle spiraling violence in Haiti. Only 11 days ago, Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry and Kenyan President William Ruto signed an agreement that Ruto said would fast-track the deployment of the officers to the Caribbean nation. The jarring turn of events leaves the future of the UN-backed multinational mission for Haiti in serious doubt. Kenya's government first pledged 1,000 officers to lead the security mission last July, but the initiative had been tied up in court challenges ever since.
And this is VOA News. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports on Tuesday incursions and casualties in fighting between Russia and Ukraine.
Ukrainian officials say long-range drones smashed into two oil facilities deep inside Russia on Tuesday. The attack by waves of drones across eight regions of Russia displayed Kyiv's expanding technological capacity as the war extends into its third year. And a cross-border ground assault also weakened President Vladimir Putin's argument that life in Russia has been unaffected by the war. Kyiv officials say the soldiers are Russian volunteers fighting for Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry says its military and security forces killed 234 fighters while thwarting the incursion. I'm Norman Hall.
Both the Biden administration said Tuesday that the United States will send a new military aid package for Ukraine. VOA's Rick Pantaleo has those details.
The newly announced military aid package for Ukraine is worth $300 million and is the first such move in months as additional funds for Kyiv remain blocked by Republican leaders in Congress. The White House has been scrambling to find ways to send more military assistance given the situation on the battlefield and the resistance to the funding from Republican hardliners. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the funding was coming from unanticipated cost savings from Pentagon contracts that would be used for artillery rounds and munitions for high-mobility artillery rocket systems. Sullivan added that this ammunition will keep Ukraine's guns firing for a period, but only a short period. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
Both President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump have won enough delegates to be called presumptive presidential nominees. While Biden and Trump were the last remaining major candidates for their party's 2024 presidential nominations, the Associated Press only uses the designation presumptive nominee once a candidate has captured the number of delegates needed to win a majority vote at the national party conventions over the summer. Biden reached that point after he won Tuesday's Georgia primary and enough at the state's delegates to put him above 1,968 needed for the nomination. Trump also clinched Tuesday, winning in Georgia and Mississippi before victory in Washington put him over the 1,215 delegates needed. U.S. lawmakers are threatening to ban TikTok, but also say that they are giving its Chinese parent company a chance to keep it running. The premise of a bipartisan bill headed for a vote in the U.S. House of Representatives is that TikTok fans in the U.S. can keep scrolling through their favorite social media app so long as Beijing-based ByteDance gives up owning it. But it's not going to be as simple as lawmakers are making it sound, according to experts. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Biden administration announces new aid for Ukraine.
The aid package comes even though the U.S. military remains deeply overdrawn and needs at least $10 billion to replenish all the weapons it has pulled from its stocks to help Kyiv in its desperate fight against Russia.
Haiti's prime minister resigns. What led to this development?
What has changed dramatically in the last week is that the gangs stopped fighting each other and rather started fighting together against the state.
Sporadic protests in India over a new citizenship law.
Protests broke out in the eastern state of Assam and the southern state of Tamil Nadu late on Monday, right after the law was put into effect.
Today is Wednesday, March 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Steve Miller. The Biden administration said on Tuesday that the United States will send a new military aid package to Ukraine. VOA's Rick Pantaleo starts us off.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan made the Ukraine military aid package announcement at the White House briefing Tuesday.
So today, on behalf of President Biden, I'm announcing an emergency package of security assistance of $300 million worth of weapons and equipment to address some of Ukraine's pressing needs.
The aid package comes even though the U.S. military remains deeply overdrawn and needs at least $10 billion to replenish all the weapons it has pulled from its stocks to help Kyiv in its desperate fight against Russia. The announcement comes as Ukraine is running dangerously low on munitions and efforts to get fresh funds for weapons have stalled in the House because of Republican opposition. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
The announcement came as Poland's president and prime minister met with President Joe Biden at the White House and with congressional leaders who they hope will spur Washington to invest more in Ukraine's defense at a critical moment in the war in Europe. VOA's Jan Bosha is in the Donbass region, and he tells us that Ukrainian frontline forces are suffering from a worrying shortage of ammunition, and in some places, the number of shells being fired has been reduced tenfold.
The thunderous roar of cannons has become increasingly sporadic here at this Ukrainian artillery position in Donbass. Just a year ago, these soldiers would unleash their artillery at least 40 times a day. Now, that frequency has dwindled tenfold, and on some days, the guns remain silent. Across the front lines, a similar scenario is unfolding. With persistent delays in aid from Western allies, especially the United States, Ukrainians find themselves grappling with a frightening shortage of ammunition. This soldier goes by the nom de guerre Little Boy. He says now there are fewer shells, much fewer than before. Depending on how the Russians move, he says, mostly we only shoot tanks and armored vehicles. The mortar teams are the ones targeting Russian soldiers, he adds. In the Crimea Forest, another front line in Donbass, soldiers received orders to engage a group of Russian troops rotating from the trenches. Maneuvering the cumbersome artillery piece into position, they soon received countermanding orders. Conserving shells became the priority. As ammunition grows scarce, Ukrainian soldiers find themselves increasingly confined to their bunkers. They say the permanent threat of drones and the abundance of enemy ammunition makes it too dangerous to venture outside. Most of the soldiers in this bunker have been on the front line since the war began, with scant respite. Many have seen their families just twice during this time. They spend the majority of their days in small, dark, closed bunkers awaiting orders to fire. Belarusians, as he prefers to be called, says it's a moral struggle. Being away from family for so long is tough, but we have no choice. We have endured occupation, he adds. We know it's tall. Belarusian has spent a mere 20 days in the past 2 years with his family, a daughter, a son, and two grandsons. He says he's tired, just like many in the front lines. Ukraine recognizes its soldiers are exhausted and now is preparing a controversial bill to draft 500,000 more soldiers into the war. until reinforcements arrive, moments of happiness may be as simple as gathering in the bunker, frying pork belly on a quiet day in this war. Ian Buesha, VOA News, Donbass, Ukraine.
We're also following these stories from around the world. The U.S. military said Tuesday it conducted an airstrike in southern Somalia that killed three al-Shabaab militants. The U.S. Africa Command said the initial post-strike assessment indicates that no civilians were harmed as a result of the strike, which occurred about 71 kilometers southwest of Mogadishu. It's the fifth airstrike by the U.S. military in Somalia this year. Spanish authorities say that two people died as they attempted to reach the Canary Islands. They were traveling on a type of dugout canoe with 40 migrants on board. Four others have been evacuated by helicopter to a hospital in serious condition. The Spanish Interior Ministry says nearly 12,000 people have reached the Canary Islands in the first 2 months of the year. Prison authorities in Pakistan abruptly banned all meetings and visits to incarcerated former Prime Minister Imran Khan on Tuesday for 2 weeks over a, quote, security alert. That's drawing a sharp rebuke from his political party and legal counsels. His party condemned Tuesday's abrupt blanket ban on access to Khan as unlawful and unconstitutional, demanding it be removed immediately. Amid international pressure over a spiraling gang violence crisis in his country, Haiti's Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced on Tuesday that he would resign once a transitional presidential council is created. Speaking in a video that's posted on the X platform, Henry says that Haiti wants peace and needs stability and sustainable development. He added that Haiti needs to rebuild democratic institutions. The announcement came hours after Caribbean leaders and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who are meeting in Jamaica, agreed to a joint proposal to establish a transitional council. VOA's Lori London spoke with Renata Segura, Deputy Director for Latin America and the Caribbean with the International Crisis Group, about what led to the major escalation in an already volatile situation.
Gangs have been historically used in Haiti by political and economic elites to push their interests. So this is not, let's say, a new phenomenon. However, in the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse 4.5 years ago, almost 3 years now, the gangs have filled the vacuum power that have been left by a really crumbling state, and they have continued to grow and expand in territory. What has changed dramatically in the last week is that the gangs stopped fighting each other and rather started fighting together against state. This is something that had been sort of threatened. Crisis group flagged it in our report that we published in January. And we very much think that this was a message that they wanted to send to the international community, and particularly to Kenya, who will be leading this multinational support mission that is supposed to arrive.
Kenya is supposedly also sending police forces. Haiti hasn't really had a strong army or well-funded national police force in decades. So how are the police, either in Haiti or the ones that are coming from Kenya, going to be able to handle this?
It's going to be very, very difficult for the mission. But the truth is that we don't have a real sense of what the power of the gangs would be if they had a serious contender, purely in security terms, right? Obviously, right now, the gangs seem incredibly powerful, but that's also because they are facing a police that has been in crumbles for a long time. Haiti hasn't had an army for several decades. It was created recently, but it's essentially non-funded and very, very small, so it's not a particularly good actor at this stage. We do think that a lot of the people that are part of the gang have joined the really out of desperation and because there was not many options for them, right? And when the mission arrived and we see it arrive, showing that they do have a military superiority, that they have the intelligence, and that they have basic things as, for example, helicopters, they could send a message to the gangs that would lead a lot of them to say, you know what, maybe we don't need to enter this confrontation, and I'm willing willing to put down my guns and demobilize.
And of course, there are international calls to hold a legitimate election right now, but how can that possibly happen at this point in time with this violence?
I think elections is something that obviously needs to happen at a point, but right now that seems completely impossible, not only in terms of institutional capacity, which is not, you know, the Electoral Commission has not been convened in years or so about the equities of who should be voting where, but just purely in terms of people being able to make it to the polls safely. If that's just not an alternative in the short term. And we have seen in the past events in history where elections have been organized at the last moment, and the international community has pressured Italy to having the elections when they weren't prepared properly for it, and they have not helped. It actually has made the situation even worse.
That was Deputy Director for Latin America and the Caribbean with the International Crisis Group, Renata Segura, speaking with my colleague, Lori London. And coming up later, how scientists are quickly analyzing data using cloud computing.
Within a couple of days, to do an analysis of almost 8 years of data that would previously have taken weeks to months.
This is VOA News. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell told the United Nations Security Council on Tuesday that the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is man-made.
We are facing now a population fighting for their own survival. Humanitarian assistance needs to get into the Gaza, and the European Union is working as much as we can in order to make it possible. But this is a humanitarian crisis which is not a natural disaster. It's not a flood. It's not a earthquake.
Borrell reiterated the EU's condemnation of the terrorist attack that took place on October 7th and Israel's right to defend itself. He stressed, however, that this must be done with full respect of international law and humanitarian law. His comments to the Security Council came on the same day the United States, in coordination with Jordan, carried out a new airdrop of humanitarian aid into Gaza and an aid ship carrying urgently needed food supplies to Palestinians will soon dock at a pier in Gaza that's currently under construction. Speaking next to the port in Larnaca, Cyprus, Juan Camilo Jimenez, the manager of the U.S.-based charity World Central Kitchen, told Reuters the ship is expected to arrive in the next few days.
It's part of our calculations, and it's part of the complexity of this mission, but we are working on that, and part of the calculation is that the port will be ready when we arrive there, and more importantly, we have a team there ready to support the distribution of this aid.
The UN estimates that a quarter of the population in the enclave is at risk of starvation, and aid is barely scratching the surface of daily needs. Meanwhile, the war in Gaza rages on, with no ceasefire yet reached in talks between Israel and Hamas. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters on Tuesday that U.S. President Joe Biden was really focused on a long-term solution to stability and peace in the region.
A ceasefire is on the table today for 6 weeks to be built on into something more enduring if Hamas would simply release women, wounded, and elderly. And the fact that they will not do so says a lot to me about Hamas's regard for innocent Palestinian civilians.
Earlier in the day, Qatar's foreign ministry spokesperson said that Qatar is working to establish a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, and not just a truce of a few days. And while they are not near a deal yet, they remain hopeful. In Israel, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to expand the offensive into the enclave's southern city of Rafah, where half of Gaza's population has been seeking refuge, to keep fighting until Hamas has been dismantled and that all the captives it's holding have been returned.
We will destroy Hamas, free our hostages, and ensure that Gaza doesn't ever pose a threat to Israel again.
The prime minister said Israel would continue to take measures to protect civilian lives, but he also took aim at the international community that has been criticizing his actions.
You cannot say you support Israel's right to exist and to defend itself, and then oppose Israel when it exercises that right.
Gaza's health officials say that Israel's counteroffensive has killed more than 31,000 people and injured 72,700 others. In India, sporadic protests have erupted against a citizenship law that has been criticized for discriminating against Muslims after Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government implemented the legislation just days before a general election is announced. Reuters' Leila Shahrokhshahi has more.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government implemented the controversial legislation just days before a general election is announced. Protests broke out in the eastern state of Assam and the southern state of Tamil Nadu late on Monday, right after the law was put into effect, according to authorities. There had been no reports of damage or clashes with security forces as of early Tuesday. Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP government framed rules on Monday to implement the Citizenship Amendment Act, making it easy for non-Muslim refugees from three Muslim-majority South Asian nations to get Indian citizenship. The enactment of the law in 2019 led to huge protests and sectarian violence where many were killed, forcing the government to delay its implementation. Opposition Congress leader Shashi Tharoor strongly disagrees with the legislation.
This is the first time that into the principle of citizenship, you are finding a law being brought in that actually discriminates by excluding people of one particular faith.
In Assam, protesters burnt copies of the law and local opposition parties have called for a statewide strike on Tuesday. There, many fear it could increase migration from neighboring Muslim Bangladesh, a long-standing flashpoint that has polarized the state for decades. Others, including Hindu refugee from Pakistan, Mira, support the move.
We want to thank the government because our community has been residing in India for 70 years now, but nobody treated us like Indian citizens. Everybody used to call us Pakistani when we were Indians at heart. We were waiting for this day to come and wanted Indian citizenship at any cost.
Rights activists and Muslim groups say the law, combined with the proposed National Register of Citizens, can discriminate against India's 200 million Muslims, the world's third largest Muslim population. Modi's government denies it is anti-Muslim and says the law is needed to help minorities facing persecution in Muslim-majority nations. It says the law is meant to grant citizenship, not take it away, and says the protests are politically motivated.
Leila Shahrokhshahi reports for Reuters News. And from South Asia, we head north and west, where Turkey's new naval agreement with Somalia places the Turkish Navy in a strategically vital region, underlining Ankara's growing naval ambitions. Dorian Jones takes it from here.
The Somali parliament ratified a 10-year defense agreement with Turkey this month. Under the deal, the Turkish Navy will help protect Somalia's territorial waters and facilitate the training and equipping of the Somali Navy. Elem Erice Tepecioğlu is with the African Studies Department of Ankara's Social Sciences University.
This will provide Turkey an opportunity to increase its influence in the Horn of Africa.
The Somali naval deal comes as Ankara rapidly expands its navy to have a so-called blue water capabilities, or the ability to operate on the oceans far from the country's home ports. Sine Özkarashahin is an independent defense analyst.
It focuses on the projection of Turkish capacity, Turkish military capacity in the maritime domain.
Turkey's deepening military ties with Somalia come as the Horn of Africa nation faces ongoing tensions with its neighbor, Ethiopia. But analysts say Ankara is well placed to contain any fallout, given its good ties with Ethiopia. Ankara has, until now, maintained good ties with both countries. But analysts warn Ankara needs to tread carefully given the region's volatility. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
U.S. President Joe Biden has won enough delegates on Tuesday to seal the Democratic Party's nomination with a face-off against presumptive Republican candidate Donald Trump, looming in what would be the first U.S. presidential election rematch in nearly 70 years. And finally, scientists in Alaska are developing a cloud-based approach to storing and analyzing data about volcanoes in hopes of increasing the speed at which they can predict eruptions. Phil Durking has that story to round us out.
When a long dormant volcano in Alaska started showing new signs of activity last year, scientists used new technologies to quickly analyze large amounts of data.
Nobody knew what was going on, and we were able within a couple of days to do an analysis of almost 8 years of data that would previously have taken weeks to months.
This new technology allowed the Alaska Volcano Observatory to conclude more quickly that the unusual activity at Mount Edgecumbe did not pose an immediate risk. But they have installed new seismic instruments on the mountain to better monitor its activity. Most volcano observation uses satellites to measure how the ground around volcanoes is moving. That data is then transferred to local servers and downloaded for analysis. But those large files can take a long time to download and analyze.
The new system allows volcano observers to store and analyze that data in the cloud. This saves time in transporting the data and provides faster volcano updates with better computer modeling to improve eruption prediction. That's especially important in Alaska, says geophysicist Max Enders.
I think in a lot of ways, we're almost always at the forefront of a lot of this technology. We have a lot of active volcanoes that are erupting quite frequently that we have to monitor.
The Alaska Volcano Observatory originally developed its cloud-based system to better handle both the growing amount of data it was receiving from improved technology and new partnerships with other observatories and space agencies. Automating the processing of volcanic data makes everyone safer, says geophysicist Michael Poland. Innovation in volcano observation doesn't stop with cloud-based technology, says Poland. Artificial intelligence will soon play an increasingly important role, and scientists hope that with faster analysis, they can produce earlier and more accurate warnings for people to evacuate when a volcano is about to blow its top.
Phil Dierking, VOA News, Seattle.
That's all the time we have today, and on behalf of everyone here at VOA, we thank you for joining us. Be sure to visit voanews.com for additional updates around the clock. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Sadly, South Sudan's leaders have yet to fulfill their commitments to the South Sudanese people, said Ambassador Robert Wood, alternative representative for special political affairs at the United Nations. He urged the transitional government to implement the necessary preparations for elections regarding the constitution-making process, the type and number of elections, voter registration, the inclusion of displaced people, an election security plan, an election dispute resolution mechanism, and an election timeline. In light of the failure of South Sudanese leaders to demonstrate the political will required to hold free and fair elections, the United States, said Ambassador Wood, reiterates its position that allocating further financial resources for election preparations, absent urgent action by the transitional government, sends the wrong message.
Assessed contributions should not be supporting an electoral process that, without urgent action by the transitional government, will not be free, fair, or credible. Future funding must be accompanied by a renewed push on the South Sudan peace process and improved humanitarian access.
For an electoral process to be credible, we must see the government devoting its own resources to support the electoral institutions it has established, said Ambassador Wood. Open civic and democratic space is essential to a peaceful and credible electoral process. Insecurity in South Sudan continues to be a significant concern for the United States, as intercommunal violence poses the greatest threat to prospects for conducting credible elections, warned Ambassador Wood.
We are alarmed by recent intercommunal violence in Warup State and Abyei, which resulted in the reported killing of 80 civilians and two UNICEF peacekeepers. We call on the South Sudanese government to immediately investigate the death of the two peacekeepers and hold those responsible accountable.
The humanitarian situation also remains a concern, said Ambassador Wood.
We call on the international community to bolster the efforts of the United Nations and humanitarian organizations to help bridge humanitarian financing and resource gaps. Additionally, we implore authorities at both national and subnational tiers to undertake all necessary measures to facilitate unhindered humanitarian access and safeguard the well-being of aid personnel engaged in delivery operations.
Now is the time for the government of South Sudan to demonstrate its commitment to free and fair and credible elections, ensure those responsible for violence are held accountable, and facilitate the delivery of humanitarian assistance.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.